fire, and the last two boulders smashed into hulls. Even from this distance, the sound of the fireballs colliding with the northern ships was loud, their wooden guts cracking and splintering. Northern soldiers leapt from the damaged ships in droves, though dozens were crushed by the boulders, or lit on fire by the gouts of flame that erupted across their decks. Rhea was mesmerized by the violence, which was so swift and brutal and captivating that it took her breath away. The catapults released another volley, and more enemy ships were destroyed. But there were simply too many, and the remaining vessels continued to charge across the bay until they were too close to the Western fleet for the long-distance weapons to be effective. Rhea found herself leaning forward, biting her bottom lip in anticipation of Phase Two. Somewhere deep beneath the water, her divers were unlocking the chains. Spiked balls filled with lighter-than-air gases were drifting up toward the surface, and then... The first ball struck with such force that the unfortunate ship veered off course, colliding with its neighbor. Unbalanced soldiers, who hadn't been holding on tightly enough, toppled into the sea. Hundreds of other balls struck, as well as the chains they dragged, which tangled amongst the ships, slowing their progress. Enemy vessels that were further back adjusted their course to sail around the logjam, but many of them were too slow. The catapults redoubled their efforts, shortening the distance of their aim. Screams filled the air as the ships were destroyed, taking their passengers with them. Rhea's nails dug into the wooden railing. She licked her lips. "The battle might be won before we join it," Ennis said, hopefully. Rhea hoped not, but she didn't respond, for the next phase was about to begin. The surviving northern ships closed in on Rhea's fleet, the two forces on a collision course, neither side willing to slow. Roth's Chosen had moved up the field, using its superior speed to bully its way into the heart of the battle, just before it was truly about to begin. They were so close now that Rhea could see the whites of her enemy's eyes, the sharp edges of their swords, the angry snarls on their lips. And then there was a second of utter silence, like the world had stopped, like a storm was raging all around them, and they'd snuck into the eye. Rhea felt as if, for the first time in her life, she was really alive, really living. Everything that came before was an uneventful dream, a prelude to this penultimate moment. The moment passed, and ships smashed into ships. Ropes and planks were flung across from deck to deck. Arrows flew through the air like flocks of birds in formation. Soldiers from both sides charged across, their swords and shields clashing. The rest of the northern fleet arrived, but they sailed past the battling boats to meet the trailing ships of the Western Armada. Thus far, Rhea's captain had managed to expertly steer their enormous craft through the melee, avoiding everything but a mild glancing blow from a pesky warship half their size. Any attempts to board were fought off by the Furia. Ennis stood in front of Rhea like a personal guard, daring anyone to get close. Several arrows came near, but missed.
"Roth is with us," the summoner declared in a raspy voice. "Shall we call on our god?"
Rhea took in the carnage around her. In front of her, the northern fleet appeared to be winning. There was a flash of fire, and one of the western ships was suddenly alight. Soldiers leapt into the water to avoid being burned alive. Hundreds of arrows followed them into the depths. There was no mistaking the crimson hue that spread across the once blue waters. Like the Westerners, the Northerners had plenty of tricks. One ship contained enormous cages. When opened, several mammuthen stampeded out, their thick woolly hides deflecting arrows and sword as they crossed between ships, devastating anything in their path with heavy hoofs and long, curling tusks. Those that died before them barely had time to unleash a final scream. Many of Rhea's ships were sinking now, joining their enemies on the bottom of the ocean. At this rate, it appeared the Northerners would break through and make landfall.
"Queen?" the summoner said.
"Wait," Rhea said.
A portion of the Northern fleet had not yet reached the middle of the bay. Rhea would not settle for a partial victory. No, she wanted total destruction, which meant sacrifices needed to be made. Two enemy ships closed in on Roth's Chosen, steering directly into her flanks.
"Rhea!"
Ennis cried, but she didn't need his warning. She gripped the railing tightly. Still, the impact of the dual collision rattled her bones and nearly flung her into the ocean. The smaller vessels tore through the wooden sides, impaling themselves into the abdomen of the mighty warship, until it was as if they were a single, mutated craft. Soldiers leapt onto the decks, raising sword and shield to meet the Furia.
"Now?" the summoner asked.
Rhea shot her gaze over the battle, to find a few straggling enemy ships still quite a distance off.
"Wait," she said,
and then to Ennis and the Fury.
"Protect the summoner above all else, even me."
"Rhea?"
Ennis said.
"Queen, Rhea. That is a command," she growled,
cutting off his argument before it could start.
"Disobedience will be considered treason."
Ennis shook his head, but didn't respond. He turned away to face their enemies. Rhea raised her own blade, which had been blessed with holy water by the Fury earlier. The Furia were fighting like wildcats, but they were sorely outnumbered. One by one they fell. A large northerner broke through their ranks, but the Fury leapt forward and beheaded him with a single swipe of her long red sword. Two more slipped through, and Ennis and the Fury paired up to defeat them. But more were coming. The Fury dispatched another two, three, four men. Then half a dozen. Then a dozen. She was inhuman in her skill, in her violence, and Rhea watched her with awe.
"I unleashed this creature, just as I will unleash another."
Then, suddenly, the Fury spun around, her mouth opening wide, her breath leaving her lungs with a gasp. A sword pierced her breast up to the hilt, the tip exiting through her back. Words scraped from her throat.
"Now I go to meet Wrath."
And then she died, tossing herself overboard in her final act. Rhea's mouth gaped open in awe at how swiftly a life such as hers could be snuffed out like a candle flame, pinched between two spit-moistened fingers. But she couldn't dwell on the thought, because the Fury's killer had drawn a second blade and was advancing on her.
"Let him come,"
Rhea thought. She stepped in front of the summoner.
"Queen," he said. "There is still time."
"Not yet," she growled.
Her enemy was twice her girth and half again her height. He smiled a carnal smile and swung his mighty sword. Rhea raised her own blade to meet the blow.
Clang!
Ennis took the slash on the broadside of his own longsword, kicking out the northerner's legs in the process. Her cousin jammed his blade downward, stabbing the man in the chest. He withdrew his blade and immediately wiped the blade on his armour, as if offended by it. Though Rhea had always known her cousin to be a strong warrior in the training yard, she was impressed by the carryover to battle. But it wouldn't be enough. The Furia were dead or mortally injured. The Fury was somewhere at the bottom of the bay. Dozens of northerners closed in. A ray of sunlight pierced her mind as she noticed the positioning of her enemy's remaining ships. Every last one of them was on the western half of the bay, speeding toward the shores of Night's End. In fact, several of the lead vessels had already made landfall, crashing right into the royal docks.
"Now!"
she hissed at the summoner, who was backed up against the railing. Without a word, he raised his hands in the air, palms open. Rhea turned back to face the soldiers. Ennis tried to shove her behind him, but she fought her way to his side.
"The summoner is our priority," she said. "I command you."
Three men leapt forward. Ennis managed to slash one through the throat, where the soldier's neck guard had already been cracked open. The second, however, ducked Rhea's blow and crashed into her, sending her sprawling backwards into the summoner. They went down in a tangle, and when she turned to look at the holy man, his eyes were rolled back in his head, his lips moving over inaudible words. His hands were still raised over his head. And yet, nothing was happening. Nothing except the razor-sharp claws of certain doom closing in. The large northern soldier's face pressed tightly against hers, his breath reeking of tobacco and garlic. Blood dribbled from the corner of his lips, and Rhea realized she'd managed to stab him in the gut during the exchange. Behind him, Ennis fought four men at once. Two more stepped around them, one raising his sword to finish off Rhea, and the other to end the summoner, who didn't even seem aware of what was happening outside of his own mind. Ennis spun around, moving his sword in a brazen arc, forcing his enemies to back away. With a cry, he launched himself back toward Rhea, flinging his body on top of her.
"Not me, you fool!"
Rhea wanted to shout, but the air left her lungs when her cousin landed on her chest with a thump. Silver slashed down like lightning, but she barely saw it, wrenching her blade from the dead man's abdomen, hurling it desperately across the summoner's body, hearing the clank of metal meeting metal. Atop her, Ennis writhed, having been slashed across his shoulder, but she was staring at the summoner, who was still alive, back on his feet, still alive, still alive. Abruptly, his eyes rolled forward, having turned bright crimson, flecked with gold.
"She comes,"
he said, the words barely above a whisper.
"Die, old man,"
the soldier whose attack Rhea had temporarily thwarted said, cutting off the summoner's head with a single vicious swing. The holy man's body fell, hitting the deck before his head, which seemed to hang in mid-air for a moment, before following the rest of him. Rhea gasped for breath, trying to fill her lungs, even as Ennis was kicked off of her and she was dragged to her feet. The deck beneath her lurched. An errant wave in the typically calm bay, she wondered.
"Looky here, a queen!"
the man holding her howled. He stomped on Ennis's knee, and her cousin cried out in pain. Still, Ennis managed to spit at the man's feet.
"Have some respect,"
he said.
"Respect!"
The soldier raised his eyebrows, his lips curling in amusement.
"I could say the same for you, pledging your life to a child. Then again, if you cover that horrific face of hers."
The man looked directly at Rhea, and Mock shuddered.
"With a bag, she might do just fine."
He reached up and touched her face lasciviously, running his finger along the edge of her lips.
"Unhand her or die,"
Ennis said, trying to fight to his feet, but stumbling back to one knee. The soldiers laughed, and one offered his heel to her cousin's stomach. Ennis grunted and collapsed once more. Again, Rhea felt the decks move beneath her. It felt like something had rubbed against them from below. Something large. No one else seemed to notice, too distracted by the captive queen's predicament. Rhea said,
"I am no child, but a woman grown. Come closer and I will give you what you want in exchange for my life."
The man grinned.
"Now you're talking. And I don't even need that bag. Your ugliness is starting to grow on me."
His tongue extended and he made to lick her face.
"And now you die," Rhea said,
sensing what was about to come. The man stopped in mid-lick, cocking his head to the side, confused. And then he was airborne, snatched up by an enormous tentacle that burst through the deck, shredding wood and nail. His scream, bright and hot for a moment, trailed away like the fading tail of a comet. Too stunned to react, the remaining northerners just stood gaping up at the sky, where the tentacle released its prey, who fell, screaming, landing face down on the deck in front of them.
"Frozen hell,"
one of them whispered, the man who had kicked Ennis. It was the last words he would ever utter, because dozens of other tentacles burst from the ship, swiping men aside, picking them up, launching them out to sea. Rhea staggered back, tripping on her cousin and clinging to the railing, which was swaying from the internal damage to the pride of the Western Fleet. Her eyes were huge, her mind on fire, her chest coiled with ropes of lightning. They were alone on a deck that started to crack in half. And then it broke and they were falling. Ennis fought to an upright position and grabbed her, pushing off with both feet, flinging them into the sea well clear of the capsizing vessel. Warm, salty water rushed over them, but they quickly resurfaced, sucking in air, gawking at the summoner's final deathbed gift.
"Rathos,"
Rhea murmured reverently. As tall as the walls of Night's End, the giant squid was wrapped around Roth's chosen, like a spider atop its prey. Its flesh was red, mottled with dark spots of algae and crusted with barnacles. A single round eye, the size of 10 men standing on each other's shoulders, stared out from its head. Beneath the eye was a beak-like maw, gaping open to receive the human forms it dropped from the sky. Hundreds of thick tentacles swarmed out from its bulbous body, attaching themselves to ships, grabbing screaming men like they were naught but tin soldiers, slamming down on wind-filled sails.
Demonos,
Ennis countered.
What evil have we released?
Rhea glared at him.
The monster is on our side, she said. Victory is ours.
Her cousin went silent. There was no arguing the point, as they watched the impossible sea creature destroy each and every enemy ship in the bay. It left the remaining Western vessels untouched. Somehow it could discern friend from foe. On shore, the Furia killed or captured any Westerners who'd managed to escape the ships, most of whom dropped their weapons at the sight of Rathos. And when it was finished, when blood and floating corpses filled the once blue waters of the Bay of Bounty, the monster churned closer, 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 until it towered over Rhea and Ennis. Rhea was surprised she felt no fear, no apprehension.
"Rathos, you are mine,"
she shouted up at the beast. Rathos roared, its beak snapping together with a crunch, several northerners' bodies still impaled on the spikes.
"Obey me."
Tentacles shot forward, stopping a handbreadth from Rhea's face. Her cousin flinched away and tried to pull her back, but she shook him off. She reached up and grabbed one of the tentacles, the flesh slimy, slick with seawater and blood.
"Leave us," she shouted. "Your work is finished, your hunger sated. Return to the depths until I call upon you."
It roared again, its tentacles slapping the water.
"Rhea,"
Ennis pleaded.
"We must retreat before it's too late." "Foolish man,"
Rhea said. With a final squeal, the squid sank beneath the surface, its tentacles slithering to follow. It vanished, the sea churning, churning, slowing, slowing. And then the waters of the bay were calm once more, as if the creature had never existed at all. Wreckage bobbed happily in the sunlight. The Western survivors stamped their feet and pounded their chests in victory. Part 3. Roan, Anis, Grey, Raven, The Beggar, Jai, Rhea. The greatest monsters shall be in the hearts of men and women seeking power. It is those who must be destroyed. The Western Oracle. 25. The Western Kingdom, the Tangle, trapped in Felicity's locket. Roan Loren. Strangely, the night passed uneventfully. As it turned out, Gareth was a poor watchman. When Roan awoke, the prince was sound asleep, snoring, his head tucked against Roan's side. Warmth filled him, and he had the urge to wrap an arm around him. Instead, Roan watched the sky brighten. There was no sun in this place, just a gradual lightening from ink-black to dull grey. No clouds marred the sky, no birds flitted past, no bats either, for which Roan was grateful. The ground was rough but not cracked, and devoid of snakes. With a fine mist swirling across them, it was almost peaceful. Roan craned his neck toward the enormous mirror, which stretched from horizon to horizon, from ground to sky. If they could only reach it. What? We can pound on it. Try to break it with our fists. If escape was that easy, Roan knew the men he'd watched die the day before would have broken out long ago. No, getting to the mirror was merely something to do, a task to complete, a way to avoid thinking about the depressing thought of spending the rest of their lives inside the nymph's locket. "An ounce of ore for your thoughts," Gareth said, rolling away from Roan's side. Immediately the warmth disappeared, like it had never been there in the first place. Roan flinched. He'd been unaware the prince's eyes were open, staring at him.
"I don't think you want to hear them. Too depressing."
"It could be worse."
Roan frowned.
"How?"
"We could be dead."
"I thought that was what you wanted."
Gareth jammed the heels of his hands into his eyes, rubbing. He let out a groan.
"I don't know what the hell I want any more."
"That makes two of us."
The comment made the edge of Gareth's lips twitch.
Can't you do that thing where your skin mark flares up and saves us?
Roan chuckled.
It doesn't work that way. I can heal, that's it. If you want, I can finish healing that sword wound of yours. The bruises on your neck, too. What about that black eye I gave you? Nay, I think it's an improvement. Nothing could improve your face. Ha! Your wit is slipping. That was a little too obvious, even for you. Let's go.
Where?
Toward that mirror.
Roan gestured into the distance.
What's the point? To get there. To stare at our beautiful faces. I don't know, but that's where I'm going. Join me if you wish.
Roan stood and started off. His legs felt like lead, like he was dragging iron balls attached by heavy chains. A moment later, Gareth caught up.
Welcome to the party, Roan said. I didn't have anything better to do. Also, you said I had a beautiful face.
I lied.
I didn't.
If getting to the mirror had seemed impossible the day before, now it was almost too easy. They reached the smooth, glassy surface mere moments after they started walking.
Strange, Roan said. It's like distance has no meaning in this place.
He stared at the mirror, which didn't really seem to be a mirror, for he couldn't see his own reflection. And yet it showed the grey sky, the rough landscape. Just not them. Gareth reached out and touched the mirror, and it rippled. He jerked his hand back like he'd been burned.
It's cold, like ice.
Roan touched it too, and the surface felt like warm water to him.
Strange.
His hand slipped through it, disappearing.
Can it truly be this simple?
He muttered.
We just walk through.
Can't hurt to try, Gareth said, pushing his own hand through the glass.
At the same time?
Gareth smirked.
At least we won't die alone.
They stepped through. Roan felt his body twist, and then he was falling, landing hard on his boots, his knees buckling beneath him. He ended up sprawled on his back, staring up at a smooth, grey sky. Gareth was beside him, his face planted in the dirt.
"Are we dead?" he asked.
"Might as well be,"
Roan said.
"The mirror spat us back out."
He sat up, studying the enormous surface, which was glassy once more. Something caught his attention.
"Look!"
Gareth followed his gaze to where something was moving inside the mirror. Or behind the mirror, it was hard to tell. First there was something big and black and furry. Then there was a flash of silver, there and gone. There again. Side to side, moving with inhuman speed. Roan tracked the movement, squinting, realizing...
"Gwendolyn Storm,"
he whispered. And then the mirror split open down the middle, cracks spider-webbing across its surface. It shattered, shards of glass tinkling around them like summer rain, but deadlier, razor-sharp daggers. The wind picked up, seeming to originate from the green and brown void behind the broken mirror, which looked to be rushing up to meet them.
Thud!
Roan groaned as once more he hit something hard, right between his shoulder blades. Above him, branches crisscrossed, leaves rustled in a gentle breeze, rays of sunlight pierced the thick forest.
"Ugh,"
he said, trying to ask a question, but feeling only pain rippling through his body.
"Yes, you're alive."
Roan twisted his head to find Gwen sitting on a stump, staring at him.
"Gar,"
he said, unable to complete the full name.
"Beside you, also alive. What happened to your eye? And Gareth's neck?"
"Hit me. Strangled him."
Roan felt like he was chasing his breath.
"Good. Saves me the trouble of having to beat some sense into the both of you."
"Ugh,"
Gareth said. Roan agreed wholeheartedly.
"How?"
he asked.
"I fought the nymph witch,"
Gwen said.
"I won."
"Dead?"
"Not yet. Unfortunately, she escaped before I could lop off her head. But without this, she'll eventually die."
Gwen dangled the seed necklace from her fingertips, the silver lockets clinking against each other.
"Broken?"
Roan remembered the glass shards raining down around him. He inspected his skin for cuts, but didn't find any.
Yes, Gwen said. I broke Felicity's, but not her sister's. I get the feeling she's kept them captive for a long time. And anyway, now that we have their souls...
She clinked the lockets against each other once more.
The forest might be slightly more cooperative.
Roan sat up, rubbing his head, which felt bruised. Beside him, Gareth stretched out his spine. He found his voice.
Thank you.
Gwen nodded.
Saving two kings seemed a worthy enough cause.
I'm not a king, Roan and Gareth said simultaneously.
Perhaps, perhaps not, Gwen said. But I wasn't willing to risk it. Plus, I need you both if I'm going to gain access to the Western Archives. How do you figure?
Roan asked.
I need you because you're a Loren, she said. And I need Gareth to ransom, in case they don't believe you're the long-lost Prince of the West.
Gareth looked at Roan.
Can't we go back in the locket? He asked.
Gwendolyn was right. The forest had changed. The trees were further apart and no longer spiked, the undergrowth less thick and thorn-free, and the vines seemed to have pulled themselves higher, dangling from the uppermost boughs of the tallest trees. For once they were all in agreement as to which direction the sun had risen from, and thus knew where to go. Still, that night they slept in a tight circle, just in case Felicity attempted to retrieve her sister's lockets. According to Gwen, the Nymph Queen was dying. But it was a long process that could take over a year. The next morning they ate blueberries from a bush that had appeared beside them during the night.
"The tangle is most hospitable," Gareth said,
purple juice dribbling down his chin.
"Aye," Roan said. "It pays to travel with a warrior of the Iron Forest."
Roan expected his comment to at least earn him a wry smile from Gwen, but instead she glanced away, looking uncomfortable. Gareth seemed to notice the change in her demeanour as well.
"What?"
he asked.
"I might have left a small detail out of my story," she said,
still refusing to meet either of their stares. Roan frowned, trying to remember what she'd said to them, what she could have left out. Nothing sprang to mind.
"What detail?" "How I saved you. Well, sort of. I did save you, but I had help."
"Help?" She nodded.
"Yes, from a bear. He helped me defeat Felicity."
Gareth chuckled.
"Colour me amused," he said.
"You had me going there. Roan, too." Roan would have thought she was joking, too, if not for the serious expression she wore.
"A bear? Like an animal?" he said. And then he remembered what he'd seen through the mirror just before he'd realized it was Gwen. Dark fur.
"It's no jest," Gwen said.
"I thought maybe I was hallucinating, some final nymph trick. That's why I didn't mention it right away. But now I don't know."
She stared at her feet for a moment, and then her eyes darted up to meet Roan's, then Gareth's.
"I think it was real. After we'd smashed the nymph's locket, the bear spoke to me. Well, he wasn't a bear anymore. He was a large man, one of the largest I've ever seen. Even Bjorn Stonesledge would have had to look up to meet his eyes. He was half naked, and his skin was covered in words."
"Words?" Roan said.
"Aye. I was so shocked I didn't have a chance to say much, but I read some of the words. I think..."
She trailed away, chewing her lip.
"What?" Roan said. "What did the words say?" "I think there were prophecies about the fate marks."
Gareth laughed.
"I think I might still be inside the locket, dreaming."
Gwen ignored him.
"The man called himself Bear Blackboots." "I've never heard that name before," Roan said.
"That's because she made it up," Gareth said.
"Roan, she's amusing herself at your expense."
"Me neither," Gwen said, continuing to ignore Gareth, to focus on Roan.
"But he told me something. Something that might be important."
"What?"
"He told me who his mother was."
"Who?"
"The Western Oracle."
As quickly as she could, Gwen brought Gareth up to speed on everything she knew about the Western Oracle and her prophecies. Gareth threw another handful of berries into his mouth, munching loudly.
"You actually believe the words you're saying, don't you?"
Gwen nodded.
"Fair enough. So you're not joking. Considering everything that's happened, I'll suspend disbelief. Let's assume the Western Oracle was a real person and not some Western fantasy. If so, she's been dead for almost 2 centuries. How would her son still be alive?"
"I don't know."
"And he was a bear first, right? And then a man? How is that possible?"
"I don't know. Maybe he's some kind of a shapeshifter."
Gareth rolled his eyes. "And why would he have helped you? Why would he have even appeared to you? Why do you suppose 8 rulers have to die in order for the Western Oracle's prophecy to be fulfilled?" he asked.
Roan had considered that very question numerous times already.
"Because the monarchs are the ones causing the war."
The more he'd thought about the Western Oracle, the more he believed she'd wanted peace. That thought only made him more eager to learn more about her and her teachings.
"Don't tell me you agree with her."
Roan glanced from Gwen to Gareth.
"I don't know anything about Bear Blackboots, or whether the Western Oracle had a son, but I trust Gwen."
I get that, so do I. But this forest plays tricks on the best of us."
"I saw what I saw," Gwen said.
"Right, a talking bear."
Gwen grit her teeth.
"The bear didn't talk until it transformed into a giant man wearing prophecies instead of a shirt. Right, I got that part,"
Gareth said.
"So he's the 200-year-old son of the Western Oracle, here to help her carry out some prophecy. But why 8 rulers? Why not 6 or 4, one from each kingdom?"
Gwen said,
"It would need to be 5 now that the South is in civil war."
"Regardless," Gareth said.
Roan chewed on the question.
"Perhaps King's Bane will kill 2 from each kingdom, the current ruler and the primary heir. Perhaps he thinks that will be sufficient to change the mindset."
"Let's assume you're right," Gareth continued. "What happens when Bane fails to kill a monarch, or the king or queen is killed by someone else? Do those deaths count?"
"I don't know," Roan said. "That's what we need to find out. That's why we're going west. For information."
Gareth wasn't finished.
"And what about my death? I was dead before Roan brought me back, wasn't I? Will he come to finish me off?"
"Gareth," Roan said, "we don't know, but we're in this together. We're not going to let him kill you. All we can hope is that the archives have the answers."
"And if they don't?"
"We find someone or something that does."
Gareth took his last handful of berries and tossed them away in frustration. He stood and stalked off.
"Hi. Someone like this Bear Blackboots fellow, right? Maybe we really are doomed."
"Gareth," Roan said,
and started to get up to follow, but Gwen stopped him with a hand on his arm.
"Let him go," she said.
"He has to cope with all of this in his own way."
"Cope with what? I told him we'll protect him. I'll heal him again if necessary."
"Sometimes I think you have rocks inside that pretty head of yours." Roan raised his eyebrows, more because she'd referred to him as pretty than because of the insult. Her hand was still on his arm, her fingers warm against his skin. It reminded him of how he'd felt when Gareth's head was nestled against his side, the prince sleeping peacefully inside the locket.
"He'd just shifted during the night," he told himself. "His closeness wasn't intentional. The prince doesn't want me, but maybe Gwen still could."
He had the urge to reach out and touch her hand, but he didn't. Gwen said,
"He's worried about his brother, not himself. He fears that by giving up the throne, he sentenced Gryon to death. Gryon is the only family he has left."
"Oh," Roan said, feeling foolish.
I can relate. I have no family left either."
Roan couldn't hold back any longer. He placed his hand on hers. Gwen's cat-like eyes danced to their hands, then back to his eyes. Roan said, "You have me. You have Gareth, too. You don't have to push us away. Not anymore." Gwen's pink lips knitted into a firm line, and Roan waited for her usual response, anger or flight, or a punch in the shoulder. Which was why he was surprised when she rotated her hand until her palm was touching his. One by one, her fingers laced between his. The sensation was like warm water on skin, more powerful than anything he had ever felt, including the pain of being nearly impaled by a dragon's tooth. His chest swarmed with butterflies. Was this really happening? She spoke. "Why did you question your own existence as a child?" she asked. He didn't know what he'd expected her to say, but not that.
I don't know. Tell me."
He was trapped in her gaze, and he knew he would tell her anything in that moment. It was like being enchanted all over again. "I felt alone. I felt abandoned." Gwen nodded.
"I loved someone once."
"The poet?" Roan asked. Gwen nodded. He wanted to say, "I'm sorry," but knew it wouldn't be nearly enough.
"When? How?"
"During the dragon massacre. Many years ago," she said. Roan rubbed his finger against hers. Though he hadn't been alive when the Calypsians and their dragons had invaded Faria, the Southerners told the tale often. They wore the event like a badge of honor, despite the fact that they'd lost the battle. "But it hurts like yesterday," Roan said. Gwen blinked.
"Sometimes, but not always. Time fades the best and the worst, dulls the pain. But it's always there, lingering, rising up when I least expect it."
Her thumb began moving against his, a tender dance.
"Will you recite his poem for me?" Roan asked, holding his breath.
Her thumb stopped moving.
"No. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to... No. I mean, I don't remember it."
"Night black, day bright," Roan started, recalling the first line from her iron gate. The words seemed to awaken something inside Gwen, and she squeezed his hand.
"Stars sparkle. Moonlight. Leaves rustle, streams flow. Lightning flashes, winds blow. Gleaming all hawks, a silver dove. So much beauty. But none like you, my love."
When she finished, the breath rushed out of her, and her eyes sparkled with unshed tears.
"Oh, Alistair," she murmured.
"That was his name?" She nodded. Roan said, "He was a beautiful poet. But then again, he had a beautiful muse." Gwen let out a surprised laugh, and it felt more real than anything Roan had ever heard her utter, save perhaps for the poem she just recited and the name of her lost love. She withdrew her hand.
"Don't make me hurt you," she said.
Roan grinned.
"I'm not trying to flatter you. My heart is simply on my sleeve. I have trouble hiding it when there's something I want. Or someone."
He nodded, holding his breath, waiting for the rejection, like with Gareth.
"Everyone I get close to dies." And there it was. The reason.
Why she was the way she was. Why not only her body was sheathed in armor, but her heart, too. Why she didn't want any friends. Why she wanted Roan to be naught but a travelling companion. He remembered the way she'd been when the man known as Bark was dying, how she'd threatened Roan, pleaded with him, implored him to save Bark before her. But he didn't. He refused her request and saved her instead. And then it was too late to save Bark. Her friend. He remembered how much it seemed to break her.
"Everyone I get close to dies."
Yet, as painful as her words were to hear, they were not a rejection.
"I'm not going to die," Roan said. "You can't promise me that.
No one can. I bear the life mark. Not plague nor dragon can kill me. I'm invincible. I'm perfect for you.
Gwen smiled again, dashing the tears from the corners of her eyes with her knuckles.
Speaking of which, aren't you going to heal your face? She asked.
I don't think so. Anyway, it makes me look more dangerous, don't you think?
If dangerous is a mouse with long blonde hair. All cower before my meekness, Roan said.
Aye, you've moved from as dangerous as a turtle to as dangerous as a chicken.
Roan flapped his arms like wings and made a clucking sound.
Gwen laughed.
Roan stopped, turning serious. In truth, I need to feel pain sometimes, just like everyone else. The bruises I wear are a reminder that I can hurt friends as easily as they can hurt me.
Gwen's eyes studied his face, as if tracing every mark, every bruise. It took all of his self-control not to shrink away from her scrutiny.
They will heal well enough on their own, she agreed.
Roan was feeling bolder by the second. He reached up and traced her jawline with his thumb.
What say you?
I say you're madder than a man trapped in a nymph's locket. But she didn't reach up to remove his hand. In fact, she leaned into his touch, closing her eyes, sighing slightly. A rustle snapped them apart, and Gareth stepped into the clearing. He frowned, his eyes darting back and forth between them, seeming to notice their close proximity.
What I miss? He asked,
seeming to sense the sudden awkwardness his presence had created.
Just Roan being a nutter again, Gwen said.
But Roan caught the quick wink she offered in his direction.
Aye, I bear the full mark. What can I say?
Roan said. Gareth's eyes narrowed further, as if he wasn't buying it. But then they widened and he clapped his hands.
Right. Let's move while there's still sunlight.
He turned his back and marched off. Roan stood and then offered a hand to Gwen. She reached up, pausing a moment, before grasping his hand. With a hard yank, she pulled him down, using the momentum to gain her own feet. She grinned down at him.
This doesn't change anything, she said. I'm still the strong one.
With that, she took off after Gareth.
Roan laughed. He couldn't argue with that, nor did he want to.
Still, despite her words, Gwen's hand brushed against his as he caught up to her. A week later, when they finally emerged from the tangle, travel-weary and hungry, Roan felt like a hood had been torn off of his head. After living in the confines of the shadowy forest for so long, everything was brighter, more vibrant, and larger. Empty rolling hills of brown grass pocked with occasional rock outcroppings stretched from horizon to horizon. They hadn't seen any sign of man or bear as they travelled through the forest.
We veered too far north at some point, Gwen pointed out,
nodding to the mournful mountains, which were far closer than they expected them to be.
I'll give you three guesses as to why, Roan said,
but you'll only need one.
Damn nymph and her tricks, Gareth said,
but there was little emotion behind his remark. Despite the time they spent together in Felicity's locket, Gareth had been unusually quiet ever since their argument about the bear. Several times Roan had tried to get him to open up again, to no avail. On the other hand, he and Gwen spoke every day, sometimes of the past, sometimes of their hopes for the future, sometimes meaningless quips and banter. It didn't matter what they talked about. Her company was enough for Roan, something he never thought he'd say after her harsh treatment of him from the moment she met him. Yet still, he felt slightly empty inside, because of Gareth's silence.
At least we can navigate now, Gwen said.
The mountain range goes straight west, all the way to the Bay of Bounty. Roan thought back to the maps of the west his guardian had made him study in his youth. There was only one major western stronghold before they reached Night's End.
If we follow the mountains, we'll reach Bethany.
We should avoid Bethany, Gwendolyn said. If they realize we have an ironclad, they will imprison the lot of us.
Nay, Gareth said, staring at the mountains.
There was a distant look in his eyes, like he was seeing something else, some memory.
We should take the easiest route. Head south to the western road. There are inns along the track. Places to rest our heads and get a warm meal.
Too conspicuous, Gwen said, trading a look with Roan. Roan shrugged back. He had no idea what their friend was thinking right now.
We'll travel overland.
No, Gareth said sharply.
He spoke through his teeth, his jaw set tightly.
Gwen frowned and opened her mouth to reply, but Roan stopped her with a hand on her shoulder.
Let me try, he mouthed.
He approached Gareth slowly, trying to catch his eye. The prince merely looked around him, past him.
Oi! Roan said. Oi!
He grabbed his shoulder, jostling him.
Gareth's eyes snapped to his.
Take your hand off me, unless you want a repeat of the nymph's locket.
The look in his friend's eyes was different than anything he'd ever seen. He couldn't define it exactly. It wasn't anger. No, something else entirely.
You mean when you punched me and I almost strangled you to death? When you asked me to finish you off?
At first, Gareth's shoulders tensed, and he looked as if he might actually hit Roan again. But then the fight fell away from him, the distant look returning.
What is the matter? Roan asked.
Gareth rubbed his eyes and yawned, though Roan could tell it was an act.
Nothing. I'm sorry. I'm just weary. I'm only saying we could all use a good sleep and a bowlful of something half-edible.
We don't have the coin, Gwen cut in. And what we have, we may need as bribes when we reach Night's End.
I have plenty of coin, Gareth said.
His grin returned, though it didn't feel natural to Roan. It was a mask, and it reminded him of the mask Gareth was wearing when he'd first met him,
back when he thought the eldest ironclad son was naught but an arrogant prince. I robbed the war chest before I snuck away. Gryon is probably cursing my name as we speak.
Still, Gwen said, between my eyes and hair and your namesake, we will attract too much unwanted attention.
But Gareth was on a roll now, not to be denied. You will plait your hair and wear a scarf that shadows your eyes, and I will call myself Montoya.
Roan snorted.
What kind of name is that? I don't know. I just came up with it.
Gwen didn't seem pleased with any of it, but Roan was determined to keep the peace. Plus, the thought of a warm bed and food wasn't the worst idea in the world right now.
How about a compromise? Instead of travelling due south, we head southwest over land, cutting off part of the distance we have left, until we hit the western road. Then we take the road west all the way to Night's End.
Gwen sighed, but the fight had left her.
Fine. But we do not stop in any of the small villages. Is that understood? We stop in Restor and Restor alone.
Gareth smiled, and for a moment, just a moment, he was the man Roan knew him to be. As they began walking, the smile faded, and Roan saw a stranger once more.
26. The Northern Kingdom, south of Castle Hill. Anis Gerrick.
Anis swore the clouds had descended from the sky and melded with the ground, and now she was floating on them. Hiding her smile was no small feat, and yet she knew she had to, for it was not queenly to smile after the massacre the day before. She couldn't help it. Waking up in Terran's arms, warm and safe, kissing his lips first, before saying good morning, holding his muscled body against hers, helping him don his armour. She could get used to mornings like this one.
I can't, she thought.
Like Terrin had said the day before, every moment was precious, because every moment could be their last.
I can't lose you. I can't. I would rather die.
The thought startled her, and subconsciously, she stopped walking. It was the first time she'd ever thought something like that about anyone, even Arch.
Is it true?
Would she rather die than live life without Terrin?
My queen,
Terrin said, his voice low and gruff. She remembered the way he'd growled the night before, and the memory sent lightning up her spine.
Yes, I...
She forced a smile back onto her lips, a smile that only a moment ago had come far too easily. "We need to encourage the soldiers."
"Queen?"
"After we begin our march, you will accompany me along the train."
"Yes, Your Highness."
"What about me?" Sir Dietrich asked, striding up.
"What about you?" Anise said.
"Your command?
Have you made water this morning?"
Dietrich grimaced.
"Aye, but I've just drunk a full flagon."
"Strong flow," Zelda reminded her.
She was buttering a scone, using her finger as a knife. Anise eyed the sword sheathed in Sir Dietrich's hip scabbard. How could a man as talented with the sword as this knight be such a fool sometimes?
"You'll ride with the first cavalry. You'll lead them. You'll not leave their side until we make camp."
"Yes, Your Highness. But what if I need to—"
"You'll water your britches."
Zelda laughed around a large bite of scone.
"It's too cold. They'll freeze solid."
Zelda laughed louder, spitting out crumbs.
"Then we'll refer to you as Sir Ice Trousers," Anise said.
Letting a smile curl the corners of her mouth, she turned on her heel and went to see if her horse was ready. Dietrich was far too easy a target, but that didn't take away any of the pleasure. They'd left the forest well behind them, and were once again on the hard-packed road that would take them all the way to Castle Hill. Lazy snowflakes swirled through a white sky, though most never seemed to reach the ground. Anise, in a show of strength and fearlessness, had begun the march with her four riders, most of whom were newly promoted foot soldiers, replacing those killed by the stone monster. It had been Taryn's idea, which pleased her greatly. "He does not coddle me. Not any more." Now they pulled back from the front to carry out her ride of encouragement, as she was calling it. They started with the cavalry. Anise offered small talk to those she knew, and made introductions to those she didn't. She commended the First Cavalry on their valour during the previous day's battle, and even managed to bite her tongue when several witty quips at Sir Dietrich's expense came to mind. It wouldn't do to undermine their commanding officer. Taryn mostly stayed silent, his eyes roving the lands on either side of the road, searching for enemies. And yet his presence alone was enough to bring Anise great comfort. Next, they passed through the lines of foot soldiers. Considering the horrors many of them had witnessed not half a day earlier, they were in good spirits, laughing as Anise offered jokes and smiling when she complimented them. Anise felt something she never thought she'd feel, something her brother Archer had felt his whole life, adoration. These people actually believed in her. "No," she realized, "it goes further than that. They will die for me if necessary, just as the First Cavalry had been willing to do." The weight of that responsibility pressed on her shoulders. "But I can bear it," she thought. She'd always wondered why she hadn't been born petite like her mother, why she was forced to endure endless mockery from insecure lordlings. Perhaps this was why. Perhaps she was destined to need broad shoulders and a strong back to bear the trust of her people. When they were alone in between companies, Taryn said,
"A coin for your thoughts."
She smiled. "I'd rather have a kiss."
"Later," he said. "But those are free, my queen."
"Well, my thoughts are my own, at least for now."
"As you wish."
Based on the twinkle in his dark eyes, however, she suspected he knew her mind as well as she did. Maybe better.
"Taryn," she said, "where did you go yesterday, after the day was won?"
Last night she hadn't wanted to spoil the mood by broaching this topic, but now she felt she needed to. If her paramour knew her mind, she must know his.
"Walking," Taryn said gruffly.
"It spoke to you?"
She knew she didn't need to specify who "it" was. Taryn called it the monster inside of him, but Anise hated using that word to refer to anything having to do with him.
"It always speaks to me."
"Even now?"
"Even now."
He'd never told her that. She thought it was only during battle.
"I didn't know that."
"I never told you."
"Why are you telling me now? Is it because of what we did last night?
The thought should have made her blush, but it didn't. Nothing she did with Taryn ever felt embarrassing. His gaze rested on her for a moment, almost thoughtful.
No, I don't want any secrets between us ever again.
Oh, thank you.
She suddenly felt bad for not sharing her own thoughts with him. He chuckled.
I'm sorry I disappeared like that yesterday. I'm sorry for what I am.
A good man. Honorable. A hero. You have nothing to be sorry for. You never asked for any of this.
Still, I hate that I have to leave your side when you need me the most.
Why do you have to? You are so strong, Taryn. I know you are stronger than whatever is inside you.
He shook his head.
I wish it were that simple. But I will not risk harm coming to you.
She stopped her horse.
You would never hurt me, she said.
He stopped a few paces ahead, but didn't look back.
You don't know what I'm capable of.
There wasn't anger in his tone, just resignation, sadness. She moved forward until she was close enough to rest a hand on his shoulder, though she had to reach up to do so. He flinched slightly, and that hurt her more than any of his words.
Taryn. Taryn.
Finally, he looked at her.
Stay with me. We are stronger together. I believe that.
I know, he said. I'm trying.
Suddenly, his words from the night before, about not wasting the precious moments they had together, seemed different. More like a goodbye than anything else.
Frozen hell! When did I get so needy?
Anise thought. She brushed away the thought, because Taryn wasn't some childhood infatuation.
Fair enough, Anise said. Let's continue.
The next group they came to were not soldiers, though some soldiers moved amongst them. They were tradesmen and tradeswomen. If the soldiers were the heart of the army, these were the lifeblood pumping through its veins. Even as the train moved forward, they worked, sitting on broad carts pulled by horses. There were leather workers and blacksmiths, seamstresses and cooks. One cart was piled high with boots requiring resoling, while another was a mess of shirts and breeches needing mending. Anise stopped at each, complimenting the quality of their work, thanking them for their service to the crown, promising them each a permanent position once they retook Castle Hill. They reached a blacksmith cart. Though it was too dangerous to set up a mobile forge, the blacksmiths were still keeping busy, hammering out dents in armor, polishing weapons and helmets, designing new weapons on long scrolls of parchment held down by rocks. Anise peered over the shoulder of a rare female blacksmith, who was adding details with an inked quill to the design of a weapon.
"It's beautiful," Anise said.
The woman looked back, surprised. Her level of concentration had been so complete she hadn't noticed their approach. A hammer dangled from a loop in her belt. With black hair cut boy short, intense grey eyes and a small angular face, she was an attractive woman, Anise noticed, though she was perhaps a few years older than she. The other thing she noticed was the strength in the lines of her arms, no doubt from countless swings of her hammer against anvil.
"Thank you, Your Highness. I'm sorry, I didn't expect such auspicious company."
"This weapon," Anise said, motioning toward the parchment. The design showed a spiked ball attached to a chain with a leather grip.
"I know of one similar, but larger."
"Larger?
It would take a powerful man to wield such a weapon."
"Yes.
In fact, the knight who wields it is just here."
Taryn approached, but Anise was watching the blacksmith woman, whose mouth fell open.
"Frozen hell," she said. "It cannot be."
Anise lifted an eyebrow.
"Cannot be what? What is your name?"
"Fay."
It was not the woman who answered, but Taryn.
"I thought you were dead,"
the woman, Fay, exclaimed. She rose to her feet, balancing on the unsteady cart.
"Not just yet," Taryn said.
Anise's eyes danced between them, trying to figure something out. The obvious answer came to her. "Fay designed the Morning Star," she said.
"Yes," Fay said proudly. "He's the only